Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Monday, the 18th of November, these are our main stories. Hong Kong police have warned they may use live ammunition against pro-democracy protesters as sporadic clashes continue near the Polytechnic University. The winner of Sri Lanka's presidential election, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, has said he'll be the leader of all citizens, regardless of religion or ethnicity. With large parts of central Venice underwater once again, the city has registered within the last week three of its worst 10 floods since records began. Also in this podcast...
First job I had was the Beatles. So that led off to that. Then I did the Stones, and then I did Laurence Olivier dressed as a woman.
The British photographer Terry O'Neill, who's died at the age of 81. Let's start in Hong Kong. Protesters inside the Polytechnic University there have set its main entrance ablaze as police made another attempt to take the building. There's been a tense standoff through the night with police using tear gas and water cannon against a group of about 100 pro-democracy activists who've responded with petrol bombs and rocks fired from improvised catapults. The police have warned they may fire live ammunition at the protesters if they continue to attack officers. The standoff has already blocked tunnel access to Hong Kong Island. This is how one student justified their actions.
I don't expect everyone to support us, but most of the citizens are okay with it. We're not asking for support, we just hope people understand what we are doing right now.
The police issued their warning about using live bullets after one of their colleagues was struck in the leg by an arrow. This Hong Kong politician, Maria Tam, said Beijing wants order restored.
President Xi said that restoring social order in Hong Kong is the most urgent task at present. In fact, panic has spread quickly through the city. People hear reports of violent incidents every day. Every aspect of our life has been affected. Businessmen, workers, and students are all affected. The economic downturn may worsen by the end of the year. What's more, people feel that their personal safety is not guaranteed.
Our correspondent in Hong Kong, Robin Brandt, told James Kumarasamy more about the tensions on Sunday.
This started out with the police and the protesters effectively in a standoff either side of an intersection right on the very edge of Hong Kong Polytechnic University. And interestingly, in one corner of that intersection is a barracks of China's People's Liberation Army. So for most of the day, there are a handful of soldiers there looking on from behind their steel gates. What we had is a to and a fro. The protesters, they were prepared with their petrol bombs, with bricks, with other improvised weapons that they were throwing down or towards the police. The police in fairly sizable numbers were moving forward at times with water cannon, firing tear gas, rubber bullets as well. Pretty nasty stuff coming from both sides. But when night fell, the police certainly upped the ante and they began to approach, to push, to pressure from four different directions. And as well, they set a deadline for the protesters to leave. They wanted them gone by 10, otherwise there would be arbitrary arrest. One other significant thing happened at the same time is that the police said they would consider using live rounds, effectively firing the guns that they hold in their holsters. That's because they say that one of their officers was hit by an arrow in the leg. They regard that as a lethal weapon coming from the university protesters, and they say the right and possible response would be to use live rounds.
But the protesters who have barricaded themselves in are showing no sign of wanting to go anywhere, are they?
Look, I've seen a similar situation earlier this week at Chinese University. That's a different university, a different campus. Police moved in, tear gas, they pulled back. There was a standoff on a bridge. That ended with a retreat on both sides, but that was a different location. It looked and felt different. Here, effectively, you've got a public road on either side, but you've got a university building in which the students and other protesters, they're not all students, have retreated within, and they are barricading themselves in. in. There is nowhere else for them to go. And the other thing is that the police, to use a kind of technical term, appear to be kettling. So they are approaching from four or five different fronts. They're not letting people come out. They're telling people they should come out, but they're not letting them come out freely. They searched our bags as we left. There are some images emerging of first aiders who've been working alongside the protesters being held as well. So different tactics, it would seem, to try and assert control over the protesters who want to leave.
Robin Brandt in Hong Kong. The winner of Sri Lanka's presidential election, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, will be sworn into office on Monday. Mr. Rajapaksa is promising to keep the country safe from militants while pledging to protect all Sri Lankans, whatever their religion or ethnicity.
Firstly, I am thankful to the people of the country for placing their trust in me and electing me as your new president. I will honour that trust you have placed in me.
The former defence minister won just over 52% of the vote, with his support concentrated in Sinhalese majority areas. His rival, Sajith Premadasa, did better in Muslim and Tamil-dominated parts of Sri Lanka. Now, a decade ago, Mr. Rajapaksa oversaw the final defeat of the Tamil Tiger rebels, a victory that prompted allegations of war crimes. But these Sri Lankans say that following the Islamist bombings on Easter Sunday this year, they feel more secure with him as their leader.
We feel so safe now, and he's the president that I always wanted. So yeah, it's such a big win for us.
I'm a Gora supporter, especially because I agree with his policies on security. And with like the recent attacks, I think Sri Lanka, one major thing that Sri Lanka needs is in terms of security, and he has the resources.
Our South Asia editor, Jill McGivering, who's in Sri Lanka, told me that Mr. Rajapaksa is a divisive figure.
He's a man who is both loved and hated. It depends very much who you talk to. People within the Sinhala Buddhist majority community here see him as very much one of their own. He's a strong man. He's someone they think who will bring security, particularly in the aftermath of the Easter attacks. And they say as well they think that he's someone who'll be decisive on the economy. The economy is in the doldrums at the moment. A lot of people are suffering, and they really think that he will get closer to China and get reinvestment back on track. But you speak to other people, for example, many members of the Tamil minority community, they are concerned about the role that he played 10 years ago as defence secretary when the government crushed the Tamil Tigers and ended the civil war. That made him a hero to one community, but to the Tamils, they think of it in terms of the number of people who were killed, the number of forced disappearances, the questions that still haven't been properly answered about exactly what happened in the bloodshed at the end of the war. They see him as somebody who is ruthless and who still faces a lot of issues about war crimes, something, of course, he denies.
And do you think in the end that's why he's been chosen in this election? Because we're talking about a major terrorist incident just a few months ago. So a leader of this sort feels like the right person for the job right now in many people's minds.
I think that's very much part of it. People are still in shock. When you just stop people on the street and ask them about issues to do with the election, almost the first thing most people say is the Easter attacks. We don't understand what happened. We don't understand how the government of the day seemed to fail to act on intelligence warnings, and we don't feel safe. I hear that a lot. And I think people felt, particularly from the Sinhala Buddhist community, that this was somebody who would protect them and that again, they would feel safe.
And Jill, do you have any sense of exactly what President Rajapaksa will do to make people safer as opposed to just feeling safer?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see. Nothing very specific yet. We're expecting the next processes will be the new cabinet. It's very likely people think that he will name as Prime Minister his brother, Mahinda Rajapaksa, who was, of course, president for 10 years, and that then we'll look at what they're going to do. People have talked about, you know, tougher national security policies, possibly something like a national database. There are concerns as well, particularly from the Muslim community, that there might be some infringement of civil liberties. A lot of people I've spoken to from the Muslim community say that they feel that Buddhist hardliners who are anxious about what's been happening in the country have increased communal divisions, basically allowed a hate campaign to be played out. Of course, we have seen some riots and some targeting of Muslims and Muslim businesses, and they're very anxious that whatever tough actions are taken to try and get security back on track, that there will be some compromise in terms of freedoms and civil liberties and possibly things like the media. But all that's still to be seen.
Jill McGivering in Sri Lanka. Thousands of opposition protesters picketed Parliament on Sunday in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, demanding the government's resignation and a snap election. Opposition parties call for the protest after forming a united front against the government last week. From Tbilisi, here's Rayan Dimitri.
Protesters have mudlocked the entrance to Parliament and put up tents in an effort to stop deputies from entering the building. A crowd of several thousand filled the street outside the Parliament. Earlier this week, ruling party MPs voted down a law that would have introduced proportional representation ahead of next year's parliamentary elections. This was a key demand of opposition protesters in the summer, which the chairman of the ruling party promised to introduce. The opposition says the government has deceived the nation and called for early elections.
Brian Dimitri in Georgia. Environmentalists usually cheer the rising demand for electric cars, but there is one side effect that's causing them concern. Scientists have been warning that paradoxically, more electric cars could lead to more mining on the seabed. Rocks found underwater contain a key component of batteries, metal cobalt. Research into the potential impact of deep ocean mining is taking place off the coast of Spain. Our science editor David Shookman has had exclusive access.
I'm on a research vessel off the coast of Spain. I can just see Malaga in the distance. Beside me on the deck is a very strange-looking vehicle. It's got the tracks of a bulldozer, the bulk of a tank, and a lot of instruments and gadgets that make it look like something from science fiction. In fact, it's part of a totally new industry, mining the deep ocean. This project is investigating the effects of mining the seabed. As things stand, no one really knows how serious they'll be. I'm with a Dutch marine scientist, Henko de Stuyter.
Is it possible we're embarking on deep sea mining without knowing the consequences?
I think that's very well possible. It's with every new human activity, it's often difficult to foresee all the consequences of that. Well, what is new here is that we enter into an environment that is almost completely untouched, at least by physically impacted. And that's something new.
The mining machine is winched over the side of the ship and vanishes beneath the surface. Cameras reveal what happens as the tracks land on the seabed and then advance over it.
What's happening here? The mining machine is going over the seabed. I guess a lot of, is it dust or sand ripped up here?
Yeah, so it's actually sand.
Sabine Halboom is one of the researchers. We're watching a video of the machine underwater. The aim is to prepare for when mining starts for real in the Pacific.
So normally in the deep Pacific at 4 or 5 kilometers depth, there's hardly any material in the water. So the water is crystal clear. But if you then make a massive plume of a cloud of sediment, all the animals that are living there are not used to it. So, yeah, they will probably suffocate.
One target for the miners is a type of rock known as nodules. These are potato-sized lumps that litter many parts of the deep ocean. And they're brimming with useful metals, including cobalt. And because cobalt is essential for batteries, if there's to be a future of electric cars, cobalt will be in huge demand. And advocates of deep-sea mining say there may not be an alternative but to seek these resources down on the ocean floor. Laurence de Jong runs an EU-funded project called Blue Nodules.
If you want to make a fast change, you need cobalt quick, and you need a lot of it. If you want to make a lot of batteries, you need the resources to do that.
And there's a lot of it in the ocean.
And there's a lot of it in the ocean.
Laurence and his colleagues prepare the machine for another dive. The engineer in charge is Ralph Langela.
People have talked about deep sea mining for many years, but it's never been possible. Do you think we're now getting to the stage where there could be a deep sea mine?
Yeah. I'm sure that in several years it will start up and there will be some first smaller types for just to check the functioning. And later on, with the current status of batteries getting more important, in the end, it will happen.
The idea of deep sea mines was first suggested in the 70s. Since then, technology has advanced and global demand for cobalt and other valuable metals keeps growing. But one big uncertainty remains: what the mining will mean for life underwater.
David Shookman reporting. Now here's news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
You have to totally be in the moment.
That's gorgeous. I love it.
I feel this upliftment of spirit.
I found it actually super cool.
What's happening there today, right now, may just be something revolutionary.
In the Studio is the podcast that gets inside the minds of the most fascinating artistic people working today.
That's always the question. Where do you stop caring? And the answer is, you might as well just care about absolutely everything.
From musicians, artists and writers, to chefs, architects and designers.
I really believe in imperfection, but I realise when I practice, I have so high expectations and I look for this perfection that just doesn't exist.
Following them in the process of creating something new.
What a beautiful clean line, look at that.
And finding out how they make and how they think.
You just have to make room. And don't think you know everything.
In the Studio from the BBC World Service.
Cut, please. Very nice.
Just search for In the Studio wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you all for coming out tonight.
Next on Global News to Bolivia, and many people queued on the streets of La Paz on Sunday trying to get chicken, eggs and cooking fuel as supporters of the ousted president, Evo Morales, crippled the country's highways. It's been a week since Mr. Morales, the indigenous leader of the country, resigned after being asked to do so by the military and fled to Mexico following a disputed presidential election. The UN Human Rights Chief, Michelle Bachelet, says she's deeply concerned that violence could spiral out of control. From La Paz, here's Will Grant.
They stream down the hillsides of El Alto, all jogging in the thin mountain air beneath the huipala, the indigenous flag. All Evo Morales supporters. Now, yes, it's a civil war, they chanted as they ran into La Paz. One of the indigenous leaders on the march, Jesus Rojas, insists they're serious. We're angry, we're furious, he tells me, especially at the police. When it comes to Evo Morales' resignation as Bolivia's president at the behest of the military, temperatures are still running high. As we were speaking to protesters in La Paz, tear gas canisters were fired by riot police narrowly over our heads and into the crowd. And this is what they were protesting over: the declaration by Senator Jeanine Añez that she was now the interim president of Bolivia. She told me Morales had sealed his own fate by trying to secure a fourth consecutive term of office.
We've already seen this movie in Venezuela. We've already seen it in Nicaragua and in Cuba. That was the reaction and the fear of the Bolivian people, of ending up like Cuba or Venezuela. If we reacted, it's because we want to live in freedom, and I think we have that right.
In a BBC interview in Mexico City, former President Evo refused to accept he had made a mistake by trying to extend his 14 years in power.
We won the vote. That was the result. Thanks to the unity of the people, we were breaking records. And we governed shoulder to shoulder with the people.
Ivan Arias is a respected Bolivian political scientist.
I think what's happening in Latin America right now isn't a confrontation between socialism and neoliberalism. I think it's a conflict between leaders who grow further away from their people, who don't listen, who govern from inside a bubble. Evo Morales, though he once represented a movement, he too ended up separating, struck by hubris, the illness of power.
The danger is that a sizable group of people, primarily indigenous, rural and poor, didn't want Evo Morales to go. Others argued enough was enough, that change was needed. With those two visions in dispute in Bolivia, the protests are likely to rumble on into further bloodshed for weeks.
Will Grant in Bolivia. The Iranian president Hassan Rouhani says insecurity can't be allowed as protests against fuel price increases continue in a number of cities for a third successive day. Mr. Rouhani told the cabinet that protesting was the people's right, but protesting was different from rioting. He defended the decision to increase the petrol price by 50% or more, echoing comments made earlier in the day by Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. I heard more from Rana Rahimpour from BBC Persian.
They are definitely scary. This is now day three of the protests. Despite warnings from the Iranian supreme leader today and the security forces, it seems that in many cities, protests have continued. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to get a clear picture of what's going on. And the reason is that they have shut down the internet. So since yesterday afternoon, there has been technically no access to internet access to any part of the country. So it's very difficult. We've only been in touch via landline with people all over the country. And it turns out that the protests are continuing.
Ronnie, yesterday we were talking about the Iranian authorities suppressing the saboteurs, to use their turn of phrase. They would have expected that to clear these people off the streets.
The reasons for which people are out on the street are still there. The protests started because of an increase in fuel prices. And the supreme leader today said that it has his green light. And it means that there won't be any U-turn and the prices will remain the same. And people are frustrated and they're angry and they don't see a reason to go home.
And as words haven't worked, do you expect the authorities now to take more action to end these protests?
Oh, certainly. And they have already warned people about that. So commanders of the Revolutionary Guards, IRGC, several of them have come out and they said that this is now a matter of security and they wouldn't stop short of anything to stop people from protesting.
And what's your sense of how much support the protesters have?
Well, according to Fars News, Iran's semi-official news agency, at least 100 cities saw protests on Saturday. That's a large number. It's very difficult to know the population that were involved in the protests, but it's certainly a widespread protest. But as I said, it's very difficult to get a clear picture at the moment until they put the country back on international internet. At the moment, everything is on national intranet, and it means that we're completely cut off.
Rana Rahimpour from BBC Persian. Venice in Italy has once again suffered serious flooding and another exceptionally high tide inundating the city. Three of the worst 10 floods since records began there nearly 100 years ago happened this week. Sirocco winds have made the flooding worse, but the mayor of Venice is blaming it on climate change, calling for more work to study its impact. These local people gave their views as they struggled to wade through the flooded alleyways.
The problem is not just a single episode. The problem is that we have been soaking for days and days.
Cerchiamo di sdrammatizzare, ringraziando Dio, non è arrivata.
Thank God it has not yet reached 1.6 metres. And let's hope it will stop a little before we wait.
I heard more from our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
Today we saw the third tide that got 1.5 metres over the standard levels within a week. I mean, that hasn't happened in Venice. We've had high tides before. And Tuesday saw the highest tide of the week, which was the second highest in 100 years. But it didn't break a record. But the confluence of so many high tides is really interesting. The mayor of Venice has been saying, you know, this is down to climate change. Now, we can't be as certain it is. There's other factors at play as well. There's been a Sirocco wind blowing up the Adriatic Sea that has sort of shunted the waters towards the end where Venice is, and that's clearly one of the main factors. But there are plenty of worries about the frequency of these events and the severity of them.
This kind of thing would cause disruption in any city. It's particularly acute in Venice because of the number of people visiting, but also because of the priceless artefacts that are there.
Absolutely. Well, the damage comes on different levels. So you've seen tourist revenues drop. People have evidence that people have been cancelling bookings as far ahead as December. And Venice obviously depends on tourism. You've seen shops, stocks in basements damaged very badly by the waters. But then really there's damage to artefacts, and Venice is used to kind of moving things according to floodwaters. But they're very worried about the effect that saline water will have on the actual monuments themselves, the damage that's caused to the mortar between brickwork and things like that. So some of these damages are going to take a while to be assessed. The mayor's already spoken of damages of €1 billion. That's more than $1 billion. But I think we'll only know in time.
And the topography of Venice makes it particularly vulnerable. But that's only when combined with enormous rainfall, which clearly has been falling elsewhere in Italy as well. So what about other parts of the country?
Well, yeah, we've all been focusing on Venice, but it hasn't been good elsewhere. At the moment, Florence, for example, is worried about high winds and rain that have raised the levels of the River Arno. And Florence has in the past flooded, very damaging floods in 1966. And elsewhere in the country, they're also worried about rivers possibly breaking their banks. So lots of things to watch in Italy at the moment as regards the weather.
Danny Eberhard reporting. A source close to the Duke of York says he's standing by his decision to give an in-depth interview to the BBC about his friendship with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. In the interview conducted at Buckingham Palace, Prince Andrew denied a claim by one woman, Virginia Roberts, that she was forced to have sex with him when she was 17 years old, saying he couldn't remember ever meeting her. The source told the BBC the prince spoke with honesty and humility. Here's our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
Prince Andrew has come in for stinging criticism following his interview, but the BBC understands from people close to him that he stands by the decision to talk to Newsnight. In the interview, the prince acknowledged that he was wrong to stay at the house of the child sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, something he felt was right and honourable at the time. He said he had no recollection of the photo that shows him with his arm around Virginia Roberts, who later alleged they had sex and that she had been trafficked by Epstein. He said that the allegation was false.
I have no recollection of ever meeting this lady. None whatsoever.
You don't remember meeting her?
No.
She says she met you in 2001. She dined with you. She danced with you. Mm-hmm. You bought her drinks. Mm-hmm. You were in Tramp nightclub in London. Mm-hmm. And she went on to have sex with you in a house in Belgravia belonging to Ghislaine Maxwell.
Didn't happen.
He was also asked if he would testify in the United States if called upon to do so. He said he would take legal advice and, if push came to shove, he would. Gloria Allred, the lawyer for some of those who say they are victims of Epstein, called on the prince to come forward and speak to the US authorities about Virginia Roberts' claims.
I would say to Prince Andrew, the charges made by her against you are very, very serious charges. And I think the right and honourable thing to do would be for you to say unequivocally, I will voluntarily speak to the FBI.
Reaction to the interview in the newspapers and amongst commentators has been almost uniformly hostile. In particular, the prince's failure to mention Epstein's victims has been commented upon. Joe Swinson, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, spoke to LBC Radio this morning.
The experience that they had was traumatic. And in a sense, for somebody to be talking about it without really referencing that, without understanding that, without, you know, reaching out to understand that pain and how they must have felt, I just thought was strange to see.
But those close to Prince Andrew have told the BBC that he wanted to address the issues head on, and they feel he did so with honesty and humility. The prince hopes that people will recognise that and that he can be judged on that basis.
Our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond. The British photographer Terry O'Neill, whose images captured the mood of the swinging 60s, has died at the age of 81. In a career spanning several decades, he worked with stars like Frank Sinatra, The Beatles, and Sir Elton John. His archive also includes photographs of Queen Elizabeth and Nelson Mandela. Our arts correspondent, David Sillitoe, looks back at his life.
The photo call at Teddington Studios was a gathering of fame and beauty. Patrick McNee posed with Twiggy.
Patrick McNee, Twiggy. Photo shoots don't get more 60s than that, and the man behind the lens was Terry O'Neill. His first job was working as a photographer at Heathrow. That then led to work on Fleet Street and...
The very first job I had was the Beatles. So that led off to that. Then I did the Stones, and then I did Laurence Olivier dressed as a woman in a chair. I mean, everything just happened to me. Come fly
with me, let's fly. A photo shoot with Ava Gardner led to work with Frank Sinatra. The image of the star striding down a boardwalk with his body double and sunglass-wearing entourage is now a museum exhibit. Like David Bailey, he grew up in the East End of London, and as a teenager, his ambition was to be a jazz drummer. But that photo shoot with the Beatles led to a career as one of the go-to names of the swinging 60s. In the 70s, he was behind some of the best-known images of Elton John and David Bowie.
When I came to photographing him, he would always have his look planned and what he wanted to look like, and so I went along with it. I mean, I didn't always agree with it, but I always went along with it.
Muhammad Ali, Elvis, Sinatra, Elizabeth Taylor, he'd done them all. By the end, he said, he was happy to stop. He felt all the proper stars had gone.
Our arts correspondent, David Sillitoe. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, do drop us an email, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. Just imagine, 5 times more savings toward that overdue home addition. Maybe even an addition on that addition. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.